wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So this week, we are starting off talking about social sciences and hard sciences.
Well, we are, except for the fact that I've got to tell everybody there's a total lunar eclipse tonight.
Oh, yes, we know.
Which we have to see.
Yes, so, apparently it's going to be really good from Auckland.
Well, as long as the clouds don't get in the way, that's all.
But, what time do we have to get outside?
Well, it kicks off at 9:45, and if you're at 11:11 p.m., that's totality. So that's when the mood's going to go lovely blood red.
That's quite auspicious, isn't it?
Well, it was thought to be in days gone by, but now we know science.
But now we're scientists, and we don't believe in that stuff anymore.
There we go. You're absolutely right. Yes.
You're still allowed to be suspicious, Anika.
No, auspicious.
Auspicious, okay.
Or superstitious.
Yeah.
Or superstitious.
Well, either way,
quite superstitious.
Make sure you go out and have a look at the moon.
Absolutely.
Or the look at a no moon. Haha. Get it? Because it's an eclipse. Okay, sorry.
Oh.
It's an eclipse.
Oh, God. Okay, yeah, okay.
Right,
well, let's get into it.
I do like your intro, social science versus hard science. Yes, okay, so back in 2011, there was a paper published in the journal Science, which is about one of the top journals that there is. So, and its title was Google Effects on Memory, Cognitive Consequences of Having Information at Our Fingertips. And this is one of those sort of papers that would get picked up by the media because it's sort of easily understandable by sort of the general public. And basically what they were saying was that people have got lower, well, since the advent of the internet, people are getting lower and lower and lower rates of recall of information, basically, because they know that they don't have to remember anything nowadays. They can just go and Google it, look it up, and it's there. And so people were essentially relying on the internet as some sort of external memory, which is what they were saying. So that's all well and good. The paper got published in a very, very prestigious journal, very difficult to get into. Only the very, very top papers get into that. Since it's been published in 2011, it's been cited 1,417 times, meaning that other papers have referenced this particular work as being relevant to their own work or whatever. The more highly cited a paper is, generally it's thought that the higher quality a paper is, and particularly a paper published in a really, really good journal. So if it's highly cited, it pretty much means that it's it's bulletproof, it's really, really good stuff, et cetera, et cetera. It's something that all scientists aspire to, is getting published in those sorts of journals, which I haven't yet, but, you know.
You'll get there.
Now, one slight problem with all of this is that in the year 2018, there was a big study aimed at replicating these social science studies. So there were a decent number of these studies that were chosen, and again, a lot of them were sort of flashy, sort of those sorts of ones that we picked up by media. And they found that this particular study was not reproducible, which isn't good. Okay, so that's not good. Now, unfortunately, since 2018, that particular paper has been cited around about 400 times since they found that it wasn't reproducible, and only 12% of the papers that have cited that in the intervening years have mentioned the fact that it wasn't reproducible. So people are still, you know, 88% of people or citations are not mentioning the fact that this is probably rubbish, which really isn't good. So this got a pair of researchers at the University of California in San Diego thinking, you know, how common is this? What's going on here? And is there any sort of correlation between, let's say, the sort of the flashiness of the title and stuff and the number of times it gets cited and the quality of the journal that it gets published in? And the answer was, yeah, seemingly. What they found was that these papers with the flashy titles, that the sort of the flashier the title and the more highly cited it was, the more likely, in fact, it was to not be able to be replicated. Yeah, and that's a big, big problem. So, you know, what's the reason for this? And again, they're sort of proposing the fact that precisely because they are studying these particular topics that are easily digestible by the general public. You know, these sorts of things that are understandable, that are flashy, that are going to make the media and stuff like that. And they're saying, okay, well, you know, maybe the reviewing bar is being lowered for them, that reviewers subconsciously or otherwise or whatever are thinking, oh, God, this is really interesting. These results are quite unexpected. I think this will make a really, really interesting paper. It'll be high-impact paper, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, that's what they're thinking here. And this was a big crisis. You know, in 2018, I think it was something like about, of the big sort of social science papers that they chose to try and replicate, I think around about 33% of them could be replicated. It was something as low as that. You know, it was
wow.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, there's a real problem here. And the problem, in my humble opinion, is that social science is all to do with people.
People love people.
Absolutely. And people have opinions. And that's, dare I say it, I know we'll probably get texts about this, but a lot of social science is sort of doing surveys, engaging opinions and stuff like that. And, you know, opinions change with the weather and stuff. And, you know, it's not a nice sort of, dare I say it, a hard science, as you said yourself in your intro, James, a hard science sort of like chemistry or something like that, where we haven't really got a human element. You know, you're just dealing with, you know, inanimate objects, et cetera, et cetera. But anything that deals with humans, it's difficult. I mean, you've got social science, you've got things like nutrition, for example, medicine, all of those things, anything that's got a human aspect to it, it becomes all of a sudden very, very inexact. And, you know, this I think is shown very, very nicely by this particular study. Now, the irony, of course, of this particular study is that this needs to be replicated as well, doesn't it?
This is
just one study, and it does need to be replicated. And the problem with replication is that it's not, for want of a better word, sexy. You're not going to get any plaudits for going and replicating work that other people have already done.
People want new stuff.
They do, exactly. And you're certainly not getting any grant funding or anything like that to check up on people's work. And so therefore, these big papers that are published in these big journals, they are pretty much beyond reproach unless somebody takes the time to actually sit down and check. And, you know, sometimes when you do that, you'll find that, yep, this isn't right. And in a field like chemistry, which is my field, you've got a gut feeling as to whether something's right or not. You've got this intuition, and you can think, yeah, no, that just doesn't seem right. Whereas in something like this, I don't think that sort of intuition is necessarily there. I think you're just taking people on trust. They do it. They publish it. They say it's all kosher and everything. And you know, who's going to waste sometimes years of their life trying to prove whether this is actually reproducible or not?
Well,
so,
if you have
a problem,
if you're a listener out there who's got lots of time and lots of money and you're willing to put the time into this,
there we go.
Get
yes.
in contact with Alan. He'd be more than happy to hear what you have to offer. So for our next topic this week, we're talking about COVID detector dogs.
Yeah, indeed. This is really, really cool. A really nice story in The Guardian last week. And so these are workers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which you might not think relates to COVID necessarily, but they were doing some work just before the whole COVID thing struck, and they were studying dogs, and dogs have fantastic noses, fantastic olfactory systems. And in their olfactory systems, they've got around about 300 million olfactory receptors. We've got about 5 million. So dogs are a little bit better than us.
Just a little.
At smelling things. Yes, yes, indeed. So they were sort of putting these dogs to the test, and they found that dogs could actually sniff out malaria. So they could tell whether you're infected with malaria,
wow.
Which is pretty cool. And this follows on from work that they had done quite a few years before, where they were looking at bladder cancer. And so they had the dogs sniffing urine of bladder cancer patients versus non-bladder cancer patients, basically. And the dogs could sniff a difference in the urine. So that could be used as a marker for, you know, early onset as well, bladder cancer. Whereas, you know, trying to find that in other ways could be horribly invasive and stuff like that. Dogs can just sniff it, for goodness sake. And so, given what's happened in the last year and a half, they then decided to see if these dogs could do COVID. And so they had a double-blind study of six dogs. I think they were all labs, golden retrievers, you know, cute, floppy sort ears, all that sort of stuff.
Really smart guide dog style.
Exactly, sort of, yes. Yeah. Yep. And what they found was that, yes, they can sniff out COVID, and they can do it basically in 1 second, pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they can do it with 94% accuracy.
That's a lot less invasive than the COVID test.
Oh, hell yes it is.
I'm very glad I haven't had to get one at all.
Oh, God. I've had it twice.
I've had it twice as well, yep, yep. And so this compares with the lateral flow method, which is sort of quick, but it's only sort of 50 to 70% effective or accurate. And then you've got the PCR, which is about 97.2% accurate. But, you know, it takes a while, as you would well know. It's, you know, sort of at least a day sort of thing, or a few hours at least. And so these dogs are amazing. They can detect COVID on the clothing of people with COVID. They can detect it if you're asymptomatic, which is really,
that's
really
important.
Oh, hell yeah. And people have got low levels of the virus. They can still detect it as well, it's purely by smell. And
that's insane.
This, you know, this is fantastic. So I would imagine that if they can train up these dogs, and these dogs take about 8 to 10 weeks to train, if they can train them up, then you'll be seeing them at airports all around the world, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
8 to 10 weeks isn't even that long either.
No.
Well, I've got a question for the listeners. I want to know what you guys think COVID smells like.
but that's it. COVID must smell like something. That's exactly right. So there are molecules there that people exude that the dogs can smell with their highly, highly trained olfactory sense. So, you know, and you know, maybe if we can isolate those molecules, then you could develop a sort of a physical test for it, not having to rely on dogs and stuff like that, and see whether you could do it that way. And one of the really nice stories about this was that not only can they detect COVID and malaria and stuff and things, so apparently one of the dogs sniffed out an early breast tumour on her handler, on one of the women that was doing the study.
That's great.
So that is quite astonishing.
Yeah. Dogs, why need computers when we've got dogs?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. We need to figure out how the hell the dogs do it now. And I'm pretty sure I'm right, is that we still really don't know a hell of a lot about how we smell.
Do we know how much better a dog's olfactory sense is than humans? Like, well, can we quantify that yet?
If they've got 300 million versus 5 million, then that's going to be 60 times better, isn't it?
Well, so this leads really well into our last topic about super sensitivity, but we're talking about noise with this one.
Yeah, indeed. And this is really interesting, because I do I do know somebody with this affliction, and it really is an affliction. And it's called mesophonia. And it sort of didn't have a name until relatively recently, and it wasn't sort of recognized as a problem until relatively recently, I guess. But what it is, as you say, it's a hypersensitivity to particular sounds. And those sounds tend to be things to do with eating or chewing or breathing, sniffing, those sorts of things. Or even something like, you know, clicking a pen or something like that. And this hypersensitivity just leads to reactions that are just totally out of whack, you know.
Oh, so I've definitely got a few of those.
Yeah. So you yourself, or
I would say like knives and forks on like China, just like scraping.
Oh, okay.
No.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty common. But my mate just has it with chewing though, which makes
and
going out to eat.
No, exactly. And again, I've experienced that many times. And so you get reactions ranging from anger, disgust, fight or flight response, and an urge actually to use physical violence. You know, it really is that bad. And they have been doing a lot of studies over the past, couple of decades probably now, I guess. And they've shown that the average sort of age of onset of this is around about 12 years old. So it starts very, very early. Or can start very, very early. And it's not at all good. And as I say, it's only relatively recently it's been recognised as a real thing. So there's a group over at the University of Newcastle in the UK who have done some functional MRI studies on the brains of people who suffer from mesophonia. And essentially what they're finding is that there is a connectivity in the brain between sort of the auditory cortex, you know, where you're hearing things, and sort of the motor control areas of your brain as well. And they're finding this increased connectivity between those two parts of the brain that's not present in people who don't have this. And so they think that this might well be something to do with mesophonia, you know. And at the moment, there's sort of no real treatments for this.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there any way to get around it?
No, well, you know, as I say, not necessarily at the moment. You know, counselling and stuff like that doesn't really seem to do it. Apparently, one way that you can alleviate symptoms is by sort of mimicking the action that's generating the noise. So if you sort of mimic chewing or something like that, then apparently that can help. But, you know, it really is a terrible thing. As I say, I've had first-hand experience of it, and it's really quite debilitating. You know, you think you can't sit at a table with other people eating. You've just got to leave the table and go and eat elsewhere because just the noise of the chewing and everything. And it's just dreadful. But, you know, it's fantastic to know that, you know, this has now been taken seriously.
Yeah.
People, as I say, are doing some, you know, really, really fancy work on this using MRI and stuff. And hopefully...
Do we have any potential...
Again, this is a start. At least, you know, if they're identifying, you know, the actual physical root of what's going on here, then hopefully you can maybe develop some sort of treatment or
even just
cure
coping
or whatever.
Mechanisms.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Like, yeah. Yeah. But really, really fascinating stuff. So,
sweet. Thank you so much for that, Alan. People really like stuff about the dogs, and they're just asking, can the dogs get COVID?
That's a really good question.
Let me Google this right now. I never even thought of that.
Reading something about animals being able to get COVID, but it doesn't have the same impact. Oh, well, what have you found?
There have been reports of animals infected.
Mm-hmm. I thought cats.
A small number have been reported to be infected, but there's no evidence that animals are playing a significant role in the spread of COVID-19.
Okay.
So there you go. You didn't have to remember that fact. You used Google to find it out. There we go. So we've just validated that first study. There we go.
Sweet.
Thanks, Alan. Sweet. Someone give this man a research paper.
Yeah.
Well, that was Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.